Welcome to More to Come, PW Comic World's weekly podcast on comics and graphic novel publishing. I'm Calvin Reed, a contributing editor to PW Now. Check us out online at publishersweekly.com/comics. Well, More to Come listeners, welcome to this month's international episode of More to Come. Believe it or not, I'm in the beautiful and surreal city of Venice, and I'm here with a wonderful cartoonist, Manuele Fior, author of at least 6 books in English, but I think you have many more than that. Manuele, thank you so much for being on More to Come.
Thank you for having me.
And we indeed are in Venice. Just so in case they think I'm joking.
I can testify on my honor that we are in Venice.
This is really a great treat. You were introduced to me by Nicholas Gravel, the agent. You live in Venice along with your wife, Ariana. And your son, and your wife, who is an agent as well.
Yes.
What can I say? Tell you what, give us a little bit about your background.
Okay. So, I'm a cartoonist, illustrator. Mm-hmm. Actually, I studied here in Venice a bunch of years ago as an architectural student. But I've been living on my work on comics like 20 years. I moved quite a lot. I live all around in Europe, in Berlin, in Norway a bit, and the longest time in Paris, where I developed my career. And I'm living out of my books and a bunch of illustration also that I make nearby with because it's a especially if you don't do it like for mainstream comics, if you do some this kind of graphic novel, let's say more all on your own, it's not always that easy to live. So I always took my plan B with illustration, but now it's let's say a couple of years that
okay, I think we're getting some of the local flavor here. The sounds of Venice. Okay, there you go. Well, I think there's more coming. Your work, I mentioned the numbers of books you have just in English. I know Fantagraphics seems to publish most of them. Have you been published by other American publishers now?
Just Fantagraphics in USA.
You know, very quickly, because I wanted to read off a couple of your books. Let's see, 5,000 Kilometers Per Second, which I believe won the best book prize at Angoulême. Is that the one?
2011.
Hypericum. I mean, that seems a book has different titles in different languages. I've seen it Hypericon in some books.
Some lands, they decided to have the Latin word, someone the original Greek word. So but it's called Hypericon.
Hypericon. And that's from 2021?
No, it's the last one. It was released like in the US 2020? A couple of months ago.
Okay.
And in Europe, like 2022.
The interview, which I have read, which is one of the things I want to talk to you about. Of course, if your visual style, you seem to do subtle changes, or dramatic changes in some cases, from book to book. The interview is just really gorgeous line work, and your books also you have seem to have a number of themes, the relationships between men and women, great banter and dialogue between the characters. You visually, like I said, you managed to be kind of dazzling sometimes and very subtle too in the color changes. I could go on and on. Am I hitting more or less?
But we came from a school of comics, let's say, that was very based on experimentation of techniques. Also, you know, the one that inspired me the most was Lorenzo Mattotti, that was quite well known in the U.S.
Yes,
he made a lot of covers for the New Yorker.
I think Fires. I think was
Fires,
the one, the incredible
86.
Yes, incredible. That was one of the first books, one of the first screen novels.
When I read this book, I was a teenager, it break something in my brain. I started to think that way. And also, it was coming also from authors like Breccia in the South America, in Argentina. Mm-hmm. Alberto Breccia, who had a lot of experimentation with the cut-off, collage. So I began in this way. So trying to think that every story had its own not style, but his own graphic universe. Mm-hmm. I guess in the last year it kind of stabilized a bit more. Mm-hmm.
You've kind of stabilized your visual style a little.
When I did the interview, mm-hmm. I was over with the two comics, Mademoiselle Else, 5,000 kilometers, with bright colors. Mm-hmm. I got a bit intoxicated by all these like very vivid colors. Mm-hmm. I wanted to go back to the ABC of comics that black and white, mm-hmm. even though the interview is charcoal. It's not really the traditional black and white, mm-hmm. and Milton Caniff.
Yeah, yes.
But in a way, it was like a European way, mm-hmm. to see it, like filtered by our cinematography, you know, mm-hmm. this kind of black and white of Fellini.
Yeah, yes, because there are some almost cinematic special effects at certain parts of the book.
I was very impressed also by some photographers, also mm-hmm. US photographers like Francesca Woodman, Cindy Sherman.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The work they did with New Yorkers, Cindy Sherman, this untitled film still struck me a lot, mm-hmm. this collection. Mm-hmm. So the way is trying to say the things like in your, you know that in US and also in Japan you have a very codified way of doing comics because that comes from your huge tradition of
authors. Yeah.
So it's not like that every author feels that he has to invent something. You have a very strong grammatic in a way.
Yes. Well, that's a problem as well as a strength. But go on.
For me, it's a very clear language, and mm-hmm. I appreciated it. Also, appreciate it in Japan. They have like a very like a way of doing it. In Italy, the market and the industry is not so strong.
Uh-huh.
Not, the mainstream is not so strong.
I was
so
curious about comics in Italy.
It was a bit like that. Every crazy people that wants to do comics has to invent his own way. And I thought he came out a bit this way. You have, mm-hmm. I mean, you have to invent something to get out of the water.
Sure,
because either you do that or you will be limited to do some very mainstream stuff that are very, even more limitating than in the US. A cowboy.
Yeah, well, that's true. I mean, there is that incredible, Tex?
Yeah,
incredible. Well, see, these. I understand exactly what you're saying because the American comics.
If you don't want to do this,
yes.
You have to invent something a bit more.
Yeah.
And that's the way several Italian authors mm-hmm. found their own way of doing it, like mm-hmm. Guido Crepax, Lorenzo Mantoni, myself, I'm the last one, but anyway.
Well, you could talk a little bit about our genre too, because the interview also is a very interesting combination of science fiction. In fact, you touch on science fiction in a number of your books.
I love science fiction. Mm. I'm a great reader of science fiction, especially certain authors like James Ballard, but also like in movies, of course.
Sure,
I'm a huge fan of the 80s of Steven Spielberg.
Uh-huh.
Encounters of the Third Type. And of course, I read a lot of science fiction comics of the 70s, of Moebius, Linkal, World of Edna. But the thing is that trying to do a science fiction today, you cannot do this anymore. You have to update it.
Well, you have to create something.
Especially because
original,
something that we call dystopic or utopic already happened. Like, think about the pandemic.
Sure.
Like a couple of years before the pandemic, if you would say this, that's story, the people would say, this is dystopical imagination.
It could never happen.
But it became reality.
Yeah.
All the world,
shut down for 3 years. Yeah.
This is not dystopical. This is reality. Reality. And so I think the science fiction can also sometimes forget about technology or how can you say? You can do other paths, no? Go through other paths that is not the technological developing or pro.
Well, one of the things you seem to like to do is to present alternative visions of social movements.
For instance, yeah.
You know, sometimes sexual, sometimes in other kinds of ways. So that's very in fact, your future scenarios seem to just very nuanced variations actually on the present, which makes them even more disorienting.
Yeah, but the thing is that the idea that we have of the future, it was for a long time, it was like a future, it's a progress, you know.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
In future, everything is new. But look at now. Now, you are using this telephone to have this conversation, to record the conversation. We are in a very old place, and I surrounded by very old technology. Also, you know, so new things and old stuff, they always cohabitate. So I don't want to think a world that is completely new. I want to think about a coexistence. Maybe something is developed, some other stuff, no?
Mm-hmm.
And of course, also like the human relations.
Yes.
If you think like the past generation, also like my grandmother, for instance, they didn't have a family like ours, so they was like 20 in the family. They were living like with cousins together.
Yes.
They were
quite
very poor, bit peasant people.
Yeah.
And when they thought our model of nuclear family, they thought it was like very, very cold and very sad to be so small.
It's such a small unit.
Like, three person.
Mm-hmm.
And the other way around, we could never live maybe 20 person together inside. So these things have a developing. You know?
Mm-hmm.
And this is what really interests me, is that very also private things that you think that are forever and they belong to yourself, they develop.
Yeah.
They changed. And maybe in the future we will have other means to other ways to stay together. I hope
at least
we are not extending it.
How is it? How does living in Venice? We've talked a little bit about Celestia. Is that your most recent publication in the U.S.?
No.
That's a little older. That's a little. But obviously, as we've talked about this, Venice is kind of surreal. Certainly for me.
Yeah.
It certainly is a perfect setting for science fiction. But what is it like as a cartoonist living in Venice?
For me, it's wonderful. I must say, I'm a bit. I give a very good advertising of Venice because normally you hear always the same things like about tourists. So of course there's a lot of problems like in every city.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, you know, it's a city that is isolated and in the meantime is very connected.
Yeah.
For instance, it's a city that it's old in its building but it's very modern in its way of thinking. Like for instance, letting the car outside of the you can never. We will never have cars here.
No, it's impossible.
But being like smaller and more connected sounds to me like something very modern. It's also the challenge of a lot of cities. Like I used to live in Paris, huge city with all the like big problems that now belong to big cities, overpopulation, a lot of contrast, a lot of pollution. A lot of things after the pandemic shows that the direction was maybe another one. Not so much traveling with cars, a bit more like making things on distance. And also a lot of people after pandemic, they went to live, at least in Europe, to smaller cities, knowing that they could continue to work.
Sure.
And above all that, Venice for me, it's a mystery.
Yeah.
Something that I cannot solve, you know? I've been living now 4 years in the city.
And you studied in Venice.
I studied a long time
ago. Yeah.
And still, there are some way of how reality works here that strikes me.
Yeah.
For instance, it's just like a very, very small thing, but it's very expensive here to buy things at IKEA. You know what IKEA is? IKEA is in Europe. If you have to buy like some furniture for Europe, you just like to a big commercial mall where you buy all the
furniture.
Here to bring all the things by boat, it's very expensive. So, for instance, the people that work on the wood, or there's a lot of it in the island. So, if you need a desk, or if you need library?
Yeah, shelves, bookshelves.
Yeah, it's cheaper if it's someone comes to you and builds it.
And just build it for you, yeah.
You know, that in you some ways, it's, and then let it.
It is a throwback way of the economy in some
it's
ways.
It's like the world upside down sometimes.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, they talk so much now about being hyper local.
Yeah.
I mean, people talk about it for food, but it's interesting. You're saying in almost every way, it's
because
probably
it's cheaper.
It is cheaper. Yes. It's amazing.
This thing, man, a lot of people, they don't know it.
Yeah.
And I hope it will change a bit the perception of the island. Mm. Because, you know, this place, we joked the last time we met, this place used to be the Manhattan of,
yes.
the 1400.
Yes, yes.
Italian Renaissance.
Yes, yes.
And I think this is not for... randomly, because the form of the city, the position geographically, you know, between the east and the north and the south and the sea. So I believe that this singularities all over the world continue to live, even though the world has changed a lot.
Sure, sure. And of course, the world still is rushing to the shores of Venice. Sometimes to its detriment. There's so many other, although obviously, I guess the tourists are very important to the economy of the city. They seem to be destroying it in some ways at the same time.
Yes, but the university is also a huge reality here. Mm-hmm. It's one of the oldest. And, I studied here architecture. Uh-huh. The most important faculties of architecture, of human science, like philosophy. So hopefully... over tourism is now a problem of a lot of go to Barcelona, Madrid, or
New York for that matter. But I mean, of course, New York is so much bigger.
Yeah. But hopefully, we will resist to this era. Yeah.
Is there a comics community in Venice?
No, this is the bad point. Uh-huh. It's not a big community of comic authors. Quite a bunch of illustrators.
Mm-hmm.
The big community is a bit more Bologna. It's not so far away from here. But Bologna is a historical city for comics. Lot of people came from Bologna, like Ugo Pratt also lived a couple of years over there.
Mm-hmm. So, well, of course, Hugo, I mean, when you think of Venice and cartoons, you think of Hugo. Hugo Pratt, of course, in Corto Maltese.
He was born here in Venice. Mm-hmm. But then he also always traveled.
Yes, a traveler, much like his characters.
Yeah.
He seemed to show up all over the world.
And he was in Paris as well.
Yeah.
But let's say three or four times in here, I'm in Paris, in Angoulême, so to have some relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And I belong to Paris because I lived 15 years. So
Of course.
So, but, you know, doing comics is also very quite, at least for me, solitary work. You spend a lot of hours on your...
Yeah.
During a
study. Yes.
And I enjoy being also a bit isolated, not like being in the crowd. When I want to go to some concert or so, I take to go to Bologna and then so
what
it's
about,
okay.
What can you tell us about when you were younger and you first engaged comics? What were you enthusiastic about? What was inspiring to you? What kind of comics?
I started very early with comics when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
Strangely enough, I started with television because in television we had a program was called Comics on TV.
Oh, really?
And it was like a strange contenitor of all the things. Like, we had also some Marvel rough animated stuff for the TV, you know, some Captain America or stuff, but really, really brutally animated.
Really bad animated, yes. I think I may have even seen versions of it.
I saw the Spider-Man was
yes.
And then, of course, I looked for the comics and it began... a lot of a fan of I began with the Japanese and US comics, the Marvel stuff and the Japanese also, because there was an invasion of animes, of cartoons, manga cartoons. So I come from the X-Men.
Yeah, that's good.
And Spider-Man, and
it's amazing.
I still love some of this. I don't read that anymore.
Sure. But it's always interesting to hear the things that
I stick to this bronze or silver age.
There you go. But it's always interesting to me to hear what you know. Well, obviously, sometimes the view of literary comic cartoonists is that you know that they. they sort of sprung from some other force. But it's very interesting to hear the background of comics very often. Marvel and DC is what turned me into an obsessive comic.
I used also to send some pages to Marvel.
You mentioned that when we talked before.
90s,
yeah.
I wait for the answer.
You still wait, but you never know.
But then pivotal point was when I discovered the Italian stuff of Matotti.
Yes, we.
When I read the Fires.
Yeah.
It kind of
same for me.
Switch on another thing in my brain, and I started to tweet a bit all this superhero stuff. I was a bit older, and especially Fires. Because it was such an incredible crossover of fine arts and comics.
Yes.
All the stuff was published in Raw, also
Every panel in that book is almost like a little painting. It's amazing.
And also when I started to see, we spoke about it. I'm a huge fan of David Mazzucchelli's work. I follow it from the mainstream stuff, Daredevil, Batman, and then I began to see what he was doing on Rubber Blankets.
Yes. Oh, what's it? Was, yes. What a wonderful book. Yes.
Big Man. And all that stuff, and I decided that I want to be an author on my own and write my own stories. And I began, like, what was 23, I guess.
Yeah.
Writing my own stuff, writing very badly, very poorly. I mean, you have to learn it.
Well, that's right. That's what you have to write badly, I guess, to write better.
Yeah. I was a bit better as drawing artist.
Nah.
But I had a lot of joy of writing my own stuff. So,
is all of your work been original work, your own writing, as opposed to work with a writer?
I adapted some stuff. I adapted a book by Arthur Schnitzler. It's a writer from the beginning of the century, also in Austria. And now I am adapting a friend's novel of 2020. But otherwise, so, and then in the beginning of the 2000, I got to know Igor. Igor, he was he's an artist, a good friend of Matotti. They were in the same crew. And he became also a publisher. He started with his Cocconino publishing house in Italy. And this was the big breakthrough. So he said, we need books. We need people that are... The very interesting thing that he said to us, we need comic books for people who don't read comic books.
Incredible point,
that
yes.
It got stuck in my brain that I should make things for people who don't read comics. I mean, I read always comics.
Sure.
I tried to address it to people that was also a bit intimidated by comics. You can try it. And it's a challenge that I must say we won. I mean, it's now 20 years that I work with Cocorino, and this graphic novel market, I mean, it's not the biggest market, but it's increasing.
It is absolutely increasing. Well, we talked about this before. I mean, in North America, the change has been incredibly dramatic. Publishers Weekly has had some part of that. Many other things, American Librarians, the influx of European graphic novels and the influx of Japanese graphic of manga. But teachers, everything has changed. I mean, when I grew up, it was really teachers not only frowned on you reading comics, they thought it prevented you from learning to read, essentially. That's all changed. Parents understand how comics can expand the world of reading. But more importantly, just what you're saying, comics for people who are not necessarily obsessed with comics like the people we know. multi-genre marketplace, and that's the world that the North American comics in particular really needed to happen.
But in France, I was very happy living in France, because you know, if you visit someone in France, he might have some comics in his library, bookshelf, even though he's not a very fanatic.
Yes,
I mean, you can go to the cinema and then understand, but you're not an expert of cinema, for instance.
Sure.
Or,
yeah.
This is the point.
I agree.
I'm obsessed to death. But
well, me too.
I can't force my readers to be. And then we have sometimes this something makes me very happy. That even now I meet very often people say this is the first comic I buy.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And it's by my
yeah.
And say okay, hope you like it, and if you like
yes.
It, but this is very encouraging.
It's a wonderful transformation, and this is taking place in North America as well. I mean, because it very even today. I mean, as much as it's changed, Americans associate comics with superhero comics only. So the whole notion that there's a whole other world of comics that might attract someone who, as we say, isn't completely obsessed with comics. This is a tremendous change.
Okay, let's hope it will last.
Yes, I think it is. I think it's going to last. And also, the incredible explosion in particularly in North America, of comics for young people, for children, and for young adults. Once again, across every kind of story you can think of, we're creating new fans and readers. Not necessarily obsessive comic nuts like us, but people who are incorporated into their reading because they want to see what this is about. They've heard about authors. And of course, the art of comics. I mean, is there anything like walking into a bookstore and seeing a section of comics? I mean, it's like a magnet for people.
Yeah.
So, but I'm interested. You have been to the U.S. You've made some visits.
Times.
You've been to the San Diego Comic Con.
Yes.
What was that like? Tell us about that.
Oh yes, it was incredible. Like everything in America. The scale. It was my first time in the U.S. So
yeah. So what year was this? What year were you?
Sorry?
What year?
It was 2018.
Uh huh. Okay.
2018. Mm-hmm. And it was wonderful.
Yeah.
The thing is that for us, this also mainstream stuff. We loved it when we were kids, but when you grew up, you always have some distance. But meeting like the fans of the mainstream stuff in U.S., I understood they really believe in it. I mean, Captain America is like a national hero. It was quite strange to me.
It's true.
Strange to me.
Yeah. Spider-Man is like real.
Like Gay Man wrote about this.
Sure.
Of course, it's a mythology in the U.S.
Yeah.
We are based on a Greek mythology, and you kind of renew this mythology with this kind of comics.
Yes.
So sometimes it's a bit funny. But, I mean, for the kids, they believe in it, and they're into it. And also my son, I mean, he's attracted to it. He's not attracted by the Minotaur in Creta, but he's attracted by the spider.
Yes.
There is something that triggers the science of wonder.
Well, yes, yes.
The science of wonder. This is what I like the most of America. That, this
and your
sense
son's
of
name
wonder.
Is Miles, too, right?
Yeah.
So Miles Morales was obviously...
Yeah, but in Italian you call it Milo.
Milo, okay.
More like Milo Manara.
The Milo, there you go. That's right.
The sense of wonder is something that in America is always very stimulated.
Yeah.
We are a bit always, in Europe, a bit more, take it also always a bit more distance, the stuff. But as I told you last time, I feel I am quite of a mix. When I went to the first time to California, I realized a lot of things that are inside of me, my culture, comes from this West side.
Yeah.
Music, skateboarding culture.
That's right. Yeah.
I was a skateboarder. I knew also Nils Anders is a skateboarder, mm-hmm. A comic artist.
Uh-huh.
So, but I live here.
Yeah.
I'm profoundly Italian. So it's a strange feeling.
Yeah.
It's a strange feeling. You are always like forced to make a remix of all this stuff. Mm. That's the way. That's the reason I can never forget like these youth readings, juvenile readings.
Mm.
But I have to bring it on another level in a way.
Sure.
Because I come also from my country, from my culture, from my literature, from where I live.
Mm.
You know, when I first show my stuff to the Italian publisher, I used to draw some New York skylines.
Yeah.
And then my publisher said, did you see that for real? And I said, no, I never said, I never went to yes. So try to draw your own skyline where you live, and don't draw from other drawings. Draw from what you know, no? What you profoundly know.
Yeah.
This is one of the first things to apprehend, and was very important.
Mm-hmm.
Draw what you see and not what you saw drawing by others.
Sure. I get that, but the imagination, I mean, you know, I mean, we're always kind of reimagining the world around us. So
of course, but
I can understand how that.
It's important that you just mock up other stuff without knowing it for real. You know, in Soho or in the comics, there were on the top of the building these huge things of water.
The water tower. Sure.
Water.
Yeah.
So I always saw that in Daredevil.
Yes.
So I used to draw it like in my comics, and I drew it very small because
never seen
them. And the first time I was in New York,
you realized they're huge. Yes, they have in buildings. Buildings over six stories have to have them because they pump the water up, and then gravity brings them to the apartment. Yeah. So this is a riot.
Stupid,
so I see what you mean. To ground yourself a little bit. Let's see. What else? We talked a little bit about. You talked about David Mazzucchelli. I think you met Chris Ware.
Yeah.
You talked about him. How was that? How was meeting him?
Oh, very nice.
Yeah. And this was, you met him here in Europe, was it?
I met him a couple of times. I met him in Paris and here nearby Venice.
Yeah.
He had a quite big exhibition that is going around all over Europe. It was also in Angoulême.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, these are the big masters.
Great artist and a nice guy.
Very approachable.
Yes, absolutely.
I was a bit intimidated by his comics and also by the pictures. The portrait is
he can be like this sometimes. Very, but he's like just a warm guy.
Especially also David Mazzucchelli, we had a very nice talk, a nice evening together in New York, where I put all the questions I had since I was 15.
Yeah.
Until the last one, and it's very, very nice to meet. I hope we will have the chance to.
Yeah.
And if you have any power to convince him to come to drop,
I will make a promise to you right here on the record that, you know, I haven't seen David much lately. I used to see him more, but if I see him again, I will say Manuele would love to talk to you again.
A nice fellow I met in Italy is Kikuo Johnson.
He was a wonderful artist.
A student of David Mazzucchelli. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And now he became incredibly talented cartoonist.
Mm-hmm.
Like no one else. His the latest book, wonderful, and a wonderful cover for the New Yorker. And a very nice chap. We were in Lucca together. You know, Lucca is one of the biggest festivals in Italy.
Uh-huh.
He was invited quite a long time ago. He made a book called The Night Fisher.
Yes. So, why don't you tell us about? You have a book coming out now, Hypericum.
This is just came out.
Just came out.
By Fantagraphics.
Why don't you tell us about it? What you'd like the reader like to think about when they?
This is a kind of double story.
Mm.
It's a story. On one side, it's a story about the 90s in Berlin, where I used to live when I was 20, and it's about a young archaeologist, a woman that. is working on a preparation of an exposition of the treasure of the tomb of Tutankhamun for the anniversary of the discovering of the tomb. And so on the one side you have the life of this young girl in Berlin in the 90s, and the city is unrecognizable, you know. It was just like a couple of years after the wall.
Sure, you'd walk in there.
It was tearing down. And on the other side there's this story of the discovery of the tomb that is it's an incredible history. It's bigger than Indiana Jones.
Yeah.
When you say reality,
yeah,
it's bigger than fantasy, because it's the only tomb that was discovered untouched of the Pharaoh tombs. So, and the thing that binds the two stories is this flower called the Hypericum that Teresa, the archaeologist, takes to cure her insomnia. It's a kind of sedative. It's used also for depression. But it shows that the power of this flower was discovered in ancient times, and also like in ancient tombs in all across the Mediterranean Sea. They used to put the flower on the tombs because it used to cast away the evil spirits. Maybe also they took it, you know, to heal themselves. And also it was discovered also on the Egyptian tombs. So it was a kind of bridge between our anxieties now, our evils nowadays, and the evils like in the past. Even though in this span of 4,000 years, this is the distance, the human being always tried to in a way fight with the same fears and evils. A young girl of today, or in the 90s in Berlin, and a young king in 3,000 years before Jesus Christ. So the book kind of build up this relationship about there's a huge time span, huge evolution, but in the same time there's something that never changed. There are some canons, there's some threats that are seems to be quite eternal for the human nature.
That's a good it's a good summation by the man that wrote it. It's also beautifully illustrated once again. You seem to, I mean, it's interesting, the color schemes between Berlin and the tomb, and it's just very different from the other books of yours that I've encountered.
It's all made by gouache. Gouache is very, once again, all very drawing technique, painting technique. But I mean, in the same time, it's actually like the latest version of Photoshop, since you can do it. Like a bicycle is a very old technology, but you can use it to go where you want. So it's a kind of a Hypericum is everything I learned to do with gouache. Let's put it that way.
But we'll put it that way. All right. Well, wow, look, this has been absolutely great. This is actually our second conversation. And I think we probably can wind it up here. This has really been great to talk to you. I'm really thrilled to actually get a chance to meet you and read your books. Thank you for giving me some of them, too, which I intend to read. I intend to read more. So, look, Emanuele, thank you so much for being on More to Come.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Hope to see you.
I would love to see you. Hopefully we have to get you to New York. Maybe not New York Comic Con. It's also a bit of a circus. But, we've talked about the MoCA Art Fest.
Let's do it, you'd be
perfect for it.
Yeah,
absolutely. So we'll see. If we put it out there in the air in this magical city, maybe it will happen. So thanks once again.
Thank you so much.